All right, so this is our second part in the series on Megillas Esther. So the last time we met, we had the opportunity to focus a little bit on the personality of Mordechai, specifically focusing on the incredible dispute that existed between Mordechai and his fellow rabbinic colleagues. Thank you, good morning. His fellow rabbinic colleagues about the decisions he made in the aftermath of the Purim story. Today I want to take you back to the beginning of the Megillah. Take a look at number one. Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, has a beautiful insight on the Megillah. He explains in number one, the Megillah is a very simple book and a very profound book. Read as a book of past events, it is simple. Whoever understands Hebrew can read the Megillah and understand its story. On the other hand, the Megillah is also a very difficult book if it is viewed not as a book of the past, but as a book of the present and the future. A book about human nature and the Jewish destiny in the diaspora. Our sages say that Esther sent a letter to the Sanhedrin, we'll discuss this passage in the Talmud a little bit later, containing one request, that they commit the story to writing for generations to come. This means that our sages believed that the book had permanent value, not only as recorded history, but as a book of Jewish destiny. And what Rav Soloveitchik is trying to highlight is as follows. The idea that the Megillah is a story about the Jewish people facing enemies, the Jewish people facing an existential threat, the Jewish people running the risk of annihilation. Unfortunately, that is not a unique story. That story is one which has repeated itself multiple times throughout the generations. There are many, many, many other stories. There are many other Hamans. There are many other such scenarios and such situations. Yet, they were not committed to the canon of Tanakh. They were not codified as one of our holy books. Yet, the story of the Megillah is. The story of the Megillah is, and there's an incredible passage in the Rambam, in Maimonides, who discusses that even in the Messianic era, when some of the other books of the Bible perhaps will not occupy such a dominant place, Megillas Esther always will. Which leads to a very basic question, which is, so what is the profundity of this story? What is the eternal message of this story? What is it that we are supposed to learn? What is the takeaway message from Megillas Esther? So again, remember, as I think I mentioned a little bit last week, if the takeaway message is that people hated us, they wanted to annihilate us, and we won, so the truth is we don't really need a holiday for that, because the truth is that's every day. Right? That's the story of the Jewish people. That's the story of our people for the last thousands of years. In fact, again, we say by the Pesach Seder, in every single generation, there is always someone. And by the way, we're lucky if it's only one person. But in every generation, there's someone who seeks our annihilation. And God saves us. So obviously, there has to be more to the Purim story. There has to be more to this dynamic. There has to be more to the Megillah than just simply a story of attempted annihilation and divine salvation. And the truth is, when one begins to look into the Megillah a little bit more, one begins to see that the true profundity of the story is not as much in the divine salvation as, I mean, that's exceptionally profound, but in the character analysis, in understanding the players, in understanding the people, and understanding the rabbis are trying to teach us some exceptionally profound life lessons through giving us a snapshot, giving us a window into the personalities, the dominant personalities of the Megillah. Take a look at number two. So the first person we're introduced to in the Megillah, Vahibim Achashverosh, Hu Achashverosh, Hamolich Mehodu Vad Kush. It was in the days of Achashverosh. He was the Achashverosh who ruled from Hodu to Kush, Sheba Ve'eshim Umeya Medina, 127 countries. Achashverosh, we know, is the most powerful ruler in the civilized world at the time of the Purim story. And again, the Megillah then goes on to teach us, or to tell us, about the incredible parties that Achashverosh threw. Being a ruler over 127 countries meant that his empire spanned a good part of the world. So the Megillah goes into great detail to tell us that he threw two different parties. The first party he threw was for his constituency, who lived far away. The second party that he threw, which picks up in verse 5, Pasuk Hey, Ubim Lo'os Hayomim Ha'Ela, Asa melech chala amanim tzam b'shushan abira lemigadol va'ad katan mishtesh shivas yamim. After he finished the international party, he then threw a local party. Who was the local party for? The local party was for the residents of Shushan. Shushan, again, was Achashverosh's capital city. So he throws an international party, and then a smaller scale, really not smaller scale in terms of its incredible offerings, but a smaller number of people for the more immediate party. So, of course, it's fascinating to understand to begin with that the Megillah goes into such incredible detail regarding Achashverosh. Where, first of all, the Megillah tells us about the extent of his empire. Not only that, but we'll get to a little bit, even after the salvational nature of the Purim story comes to a close, the Megillah still tells us even more about Achashverosh. Achashverosh is a dominant character in the story. Now, I'll say, of course, he's a dominant character. He's the one who signs the death sentence of the Jewish people. But even so, the Megillah still goes out of its way to teach us so much about him. If you look at number three, so the Gemara records an incredible dispute regarding Achashverosh. Rav Shmuel, the two great rabbis, Rav and Shmuel, argued with each other. Chad Amar once said, Melech Pikeachaya. Achashverosh was exceptionally wise. The Chad Amar, the other said, Melech Tipesh Haya. What does Tipesh mean? Foolish. Foolish king. So the Gemara, so where does this dispute center on? Mandamar Melech Pikeach Haya, Shapir Avid Dekarev Rechika Bereisha. So interestingly enough, the dispute seems to hinge on how to understand Achashverosh's approach to his empire parties. What does that mean? That if you look at the way he structured the parties, he first invited the dignitaries and noblemen from the faraway countries, and then only invited the noblemen and dignitaries from his own backyard. So the one who said that he was very smart is, remember, if you are, this is good to know, if you rule over a large empire, what's your number one concern? Revolts. Right? Remember, again, you don't want people rebelling. So what's the best way to prevent people from rebelling? Invite them to a party. Make them feel important. Make them feel valued. Make them feel that they are part of your inner circle. So the first opinion that says Achashverosh was very wise is he purposely went out of his way to invite the people far away to the first party, because he figured the noblemen, the dignitaries in Shushan, I could appease them at any time. I could always smooth things over with them at any time. The people far away, remember again, you know, we live in such different times that we can know what's happening on the other side of the world, you know, in a nanosecond. For Achashverosh, if you're ruling over 127 countries and your empire spans a good part of the world, there could be stuff happening by the edge, by the periphery of your empire, and you have absolutely no idea what's going on. So he needs to first solidify the outliers, solidify the outlying provinces, and then we'll work on the people on the inside. The other opinion said he was a fool. Why was he a fool? Because when it's consolidating or solidifying your empire, who do you look to first? The people in your backyard. You need to make sure that the people closest to you are firmly embedded with you. So he really should have had the party for the Shushan people first, and then invited the people on the outside afterwards. Now this is part of an ongoing dispute regarding the character of Achashverosh. What kind of person are we dealing with? Are we dealing with someone who is exceptionally shrewd, exceptionally cunning, a seasoned statesman? Or are we dealing with a fool? And when we say a fool, by the way, a fool doesn't mean that he lacks intellectual capacity. A fool doesn't mean that he lacks smarts. But to rule an empire requires a dramatically different type of skill set. So when the rabbi said that he was a fool, no one becomes the mightiest ruler of the civilized world if they're a fool. But rather, again, what it means is he wasn't a seasoned statesman. So that's the fundamental dispute. Hold on to this for just a moment. So I'll tell you, you know, my children have like these Megillahs, these children Megillahs. And in the Megillah, and it's a pictorial Megillah, you always have these pictures of Achashverosh. And to be honest, he looks a bit foolish. And it always bothered me because I never understood, how could he be foolish? You want to say that he wasn't a great king. You want to say that he wasn't a good ruler. You want to say that he wasn't a seasoned statesman. That's one thing. But foolish sounds strange to say about the most powerful man of the civilized world. So what is it? What, there's a tension here. The same way we saw a tension about Mordechai, there's a tension about Achashverosh as well. What's the tension? So to appreciate this, we have to take a step back. Who is it? And ask ourselves a simple fundamental question, which is, who is it that wrote the Megillah? So if you take a look at number 4, so at the end of the Megillah, this is in the 9th chapter. Remember again, the Megillah has 10 chapters. The 10th chapter only has a couple of verses. So the story really ends by the end of the 9th chapter. And here the Megillah says, Vayichtov Mordechai Sadvarim Ha'ilah, Vayishlach Svarim El Kola Yehudim Asher B'chol Medina Samelach Hasherosh, Hakrov Marachokim, Lekayim Aleihem, Leos Osim Es Yom Arbaasar L'Chodesh Adar Ves Yom Chamishas Arbao B'chol Shana V'Shana. So again, a simple reading is, who wrote the Megillah? Mordechai wrote the Megillah. And after he wrote the Megillah, he went ahead and he dispatched this ultimately again to all the Jewish communities and institutionalized the observance of the Purim holiday. If you look at Rashi in number 5, so Rashi says, Vayichtov Mordechai, He HaMegillah HaZos Kimos Shehi. Literally, the Megillah as we have it today. The Megillah as we have it today, number 5, Rashi. The Megillah as we have it today was written by Mordechai. Yet, interestingly enough, if you take a look at number 6, so what happens? So the Megillah says, Vatichtov Esther Hamalka Bas Avichail, or Mordechai HaYehudi is called Tokef, Lekayim Esigeres HaPurim HaZos HaShenis. That ultimately here the Megillah says, well, it wasn't only Mordechai, Esther also had a hand in writing the Megillah. Vayishlach svarim al kol Yehudim, v'alsheva v'eshim l'meyam medinos, malchus achashirosh, divrei shalom v'emes. So again, you begin to see that the writing of the Megillah was a joint exercise, right? A collaborative endeavor between Mordechai and Esther. Now here's what's fascinating. If at the end of the day, the Megillah is written by 2 Jews, then we assume that the thrust of the story was what? Why did they write it down? Why did they write it down? For generations to come. For what purpose? What's the message? To learn something. Thank you. Right? Learn what? Learn what? Could be how to deal with diaspora good. You're thinking too much. To learn what? I'm sorry? Jewish history. Great. Why? Sandy, is the coffee caffeinated here? It's caffeinated? Okay, so maybe you have to like espresso next time. Good. Why? Why? What's the message? Good conquers evil, more specifically? God. Let's not forget God, right? God. Right? God. It's a story about the salvation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's the idea that even when you don't see God, He's there. That even when God is not splitting seas or bringing pharaohs to their knees, He is working all of the circumstances behind the scene. And even if His name doesn't show up once in the entire Megillah, He is absolutely there. My friends, that is the message of the Megillah. The primary message of the Megillah is that Ribono Shel Olam is always with us. And even when we feel forsaken, and even when we feel alone, and even when we feel at the mercy of unpredictable dictators, tyrants, even when we feel like the deck is stacked against us, and there is no hope for salvation, God always has our back. If that's the point of the Megillah, then why so much information about Achashverosh? If this is supposed to be a Jewish story, if this is supposed to be really a theological story, not just a historical story, because remember, if it's a historical story, there's a lot of pieces of information that are missing. A lot of pieces of information that are missing. By the way, one of the most important pieces of information that's missing from the story is what? A piece of information that happened after the close of the Purim story, which is, what's the real byproduct of the Purim story? Esther and Achashverosh have a son. What's their son's name? Darius, Daryavesh. Daryavesh is responsible for the commissioning of the building of the second temple. That is the real conclusion of this story. that the young Jewish girl forcibly taken from her home, married to a man, ultimately that she did not want to be married to, conscripted to a life that she did not want to be, she did not want for herself, becomes the mother of an incredibly powerful monarch, who of course was Jewish, didn't really acknowledge his Jewish identity, that was not really his persona, but was responsible for the rebuilding, the beginning of the rebuilding, of the second temple. Yet, that's not there either. And remember, not only that, the Megillah ends with interesting bookends. What are the interesting bookends? Remember, we started in number one, which is actually number two on your sheet. Vahim Achashverosh. Achashverosh goes ahead, right? Tells about Achashverosh. He's Achashverosh. He's powerful, 127 countries. Now, remember, you'll look at your Megillah on Purim, and you'll notice there's something very interesting, which is Megillas Esther should have really ended at the end of the ninth chapter. What I'm quoting to you in number six is the end of the ninth chapter. Mordechai and Esther write down the Megillah. They go ahead and they send out to the Jewish communities, let's make a Yom Tov, let's make a holiday. Fantastic, we're done. But that's not how the Megillah ends. If you take a look at number 8, here's how the Megillah ends. Number 8. Vayasa HaMelech Achashverosh Mas Al HaAretz V'Iye Hayam. Achashverosh, how does the Megillah end? How does it end? Taxes. Right? At the end of the day, all stories end with higher taxes. Right? So taxes! Achashverosh levied the taxes back. By the way, what does this have to do with the story? Because you remember, when Achashverosh marries Esther, no one knows who this girl is, no one knows her nationality, no one knows her parents, nothing. Achashverosh is so happy, we'll discuss why he's so happy. And what does he do in celebration? There's an empire-wide celebration, what did he do? He lowers taxes. There was a tax break. L'chala medinos. In celebration of Achashverosh's new marriage, we are going to suspend the tax laws. How does the Megillah end? Party's over. Right? Party's over. Life is back to normal. Taxes are back on. V'chol ma'asei tokfo u'gvuroso u'parshos. U'parshas gedulas Mordechai shagilo ha'melech alohim k'suvam sefer yamim l'malchus madei ha'paros. Amazing. How does the Megillah end? The Megillah ends by telling us that Achashverosh put the taxes back, literally on the land. Iyahya means on the islands. And that's how the Megillah ends. So the Megillah begins with the story of the greatness of Achashverosh, and it ends with the story of the greatness of Achashverosh. Now, one more piece. Take a look at number 9. There's another Gemara Maseches Megillah. The Gemara says, Amar Rav Shlomo bar Yehuda, Shalchu lahem Esther lechachamim. Esther sent a message to the rabbis. What was the message? She said, Kivuni ledoros. I want you to take the Megillah that Mordechai and I wrote, and I want you to include it in the body that's called Tanakh. And I want you to establish my holiday, meaning this holiday of Purim, as one of the rabbinic holidays in Judaism. Shalchula, so I said to Esther, we would love to, but kina at ma'oreres aleinu lebeina umos. You're going to make problems for the Jews. You're going to make problems for the Jews, because what's going to happen? If we start publicizing stories about how Jews are controlling empires, right? How Jews are controlling kings, right? How Jews are going ahead and defeating mighty Gentiles. We know the stories, but it's not always good to broadcast those stories. Sometimes those stories, especially again for the Jew in the Jew in the diaspora, always walks this incredibly fine line. On one hand, it is our job to not live in the cocoon of the community. It is our job to go out into greater society, to influence, and to make a contribution. That is our job. That is the divine mandate we have. On the flip side, we also have to sometimes be careful with our profile. We have to be careful with when we're in the limelight, when we're not in the limelight. You know, I'll give you just a simple example without getting political for just a moment. It's wonderful that Sheldon Adelson went ahead and is willing to donate $500 million to move the embassy to Yerushalayim. Would it be better if it was done behind the scenes? Absolutely. Why? Because the world doesn't need to see that a Jewish billionaire is involved in American diplomatic policy. It's not good for us. It doesn't, again, whatever our independent things about politics, leaving that aside, I don't, this is just my opinion, I don't know that necessarily every, people read that and say, yay for the Jews, fantastic, incredible. This is the fine line that we walk in the realm of diaspora life. We want to contribute, we want to be front and center, we want to help, but at the same time we must always be mindful about how what we do and what we say will be perceived by the greater world. So Esther says, I want you to include Megillah Esther as part of Tanakh, we should make it a Yom Tov. The rabbis say, one second. What are the Persians going to say? Right? What are the Gentile nations going to say when we're celebrating a Yom Tov that essentially recognizes their defeat? Not only that, but remember, we killed a lot of the Gentile nations during the Purim story as well. Everyone who came to kill us, we rose up. This wasn't just the fact that God provided us a salvation and we stayed home and ate shalent. Meaning on that day, when they were supposed to kill us, we took up arms and we killed them. We killed them. There were thousands of people who were killed by the Jews on the 14th and 15th of Adar. So again, this was a Jewish military event also. Not just a spiritual salvation. It wasn't just God. We did a lot also. So the rabbis say to Esther, I don't know if it's such a good idea for us to publicize this. And what does Esther respond? Number 9, second line. Shalcha lahem kvar ksuva ani al divra yom lemalchei madayu paras. What does Esther say? Don't worry, because the Megillah is already included in the historical record of the Persian Median Empire. Meaning, at the end of it, what Esther says is, this story that Mordechai and I wrote has been accepted as part of the official historical narrative of the Persian Median Empire. In other words, everyone knows the story already. And Esther essentially says in parentheses, there's nothing to worry about. Why is there nothing to worry about? Why is nothing to worry about? Because it makes the king look great. Because at the end of the day, Ahasuerus emerges from this as a hero of the story. Ahasuerus emerges from this as the man who sided with good, as the man who went ahead, who was originally being manipulated by Haman. And again, the narrative makes it clear that Haman was being manipulative. Ultimately, Ahasuerus rises above it with the help of his anonymous queen. And we'll discuss why that is in just a little bit. See, he comes out looking good. So don't worry about it, Esther says to the rabbis. The Persian Median Empire, they've already included this book as part of the historical narrative. There's nothing to worry about. So it appears that the rabbis took Esther's advice, and that's why, again, the Megillah is part of Tanakh. Purim is a Yom Tov. But what does this show us? If you take a look at number 10, we're not going to do all of this inside. I put it on the sheets. You can look at it on your own more. If you take a look at number 10, so, interestingly enough, this is from a sefer. This is from a book called Ka'ayal Ta'arog. So this is from a Rav Eliakim Levanon, who was a Rav in Kiryat Arba in Eretz Yisrael. And he has a beautiful perush, a beautiful commentary on Megillas Esther. And essentially what he develops is this incredible idea that Mordechai and Esther understood that Ahasuerus was an egomaniac. That Ahasuerus, at the end of the day, needed incredible praise. That Ahasuerus, everything that Ahasuerus did was motivated by one simple thing. What is going to give me power? What is going to stoke my ego? What is it that is going to serve my needs? And whatever the answer to that question is, that is the side in which I will align myself. So for example, in number 10, Rav Levanon makes an amazing statement. He says, if you'll notice, I mentioned this before, whose name is missing from the Megillah? God. God. Why is God's name not in the Megillah? So, you know, the Jewish answer to that is, why is God's name not in the Megillah? Because God was behind the scenes. Let's say, as opposed to contrasting it with the Egyptian Exodus, where God is everywhere because the hand of God was revealed. In the Purim story, again, God is very much behind the scenes, working the order of the natural world. Rav Levanon says there's a simpler reason. Because Mordechai wrote Megillas Esther for who? He wrote it ultimately again to be included in the Persian Median annals of history as well. And therefore again, who had to be the dominant character in the story? Ahasuerus. There is no mention of God in the Megillah says Rav Levanon, and it's such an incredible insight, because any mention of God takes away from Ahasuerus' power and prominence. Any mention of God takes away from Ahasuerus' role as the star of the show. He's the one who makes the decisions. He's the one who choreographs the details. He's the one who chose to align with Haman and then switches allegiance to Esther. It has nothing to do with God, nothing to do with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is why, by the way, what does Mordechai do? Mordechai does something amazing. What he does is, he creates, Mordechai and Esther, create the Megillah that effectively could be read in two different ways. It could be read with Gentile eyes, and it could be read with Jewish eyes. If it's read with Gentile eyes, it's the story of a great king, Ahasuerosh, who was manipulated but then rose above the manipulation, right? Who grew his empire with the help of his bride by his side. If you read it through Jewish eyes, the rabbis make an amazing observation. They say, there's one word, what is the one word that appears the most times throughout the Megillah? One word, Melech, the king. So the rabbis in the Talmud explain that wherever the word king appears in the Megillah, it's in fact a veiled reference to God. It's a veiled reference to God. Because HaMelech appears at almost every pivotal moment in the Megillah. All of those moments that Ahasuerus thinks that he's controlling the circumstances, it's really Lev Melachim Biyat Hashem. The heart of the ruler is in the hands of God. It is God ultimately, again, who is choreographing this entire thing, but from behind the scenes. So Rav Levanon says, Mordechai does not insert any type of reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, any reference to God, because ultimately, again, he knows that this book needs to be about Ahasuerus. This is going to go ahead and go into the annals of Persian medium history, and therefore Ahasuerus has to be the dominant person. Take a look at number 11. So Rav Levanon writes, he says, Malo osa Ahasuerus kedei lehiskabed. What won't Ahasuerus do in order to gain honor? As Kol Maritzo, who mashkia b'shnei advarim. So he says something amazing. Malchus v'kavod. Everything that Ahasuerus does, he does one of two reasons. Either to expand his monarchy, or to stoke his ego, for kavod, for honor, which is really one and the same. Who muchan laroch mishte b'meh v'shmonim yom, kedei laharos l'inei akolos kvodova ushro. Ahasuerus makes a party for 180 days. Who even has the koach to party for 180 days? And Ahasuerus is not a young man, right? 180 days. And what was the whole point? The whole point was an incredible display of his affluence. The whole point was to show off. Was to show off his treasure houses. Vashtia kedas in ones lasos ritzon ish v'ish. Say, and again, he's look at the last paragraph, number 11. Machalas hagaiva goremes la'adam la'asos ma'aseh shtus. When a person is seized by arrogance, he does foolish things. The gamachareim who nirachacham gadol be'ini atzmo. And here's the amazing part: when he's arrogant and he does foolish things, he's so arrogant that he doesn't even realize how foolish he looks. He's so arrogant that at the end of the day, he thinks that what he's doing makes sense. He thinks that what he's doing is logical. He thinks that what he's doing looks so smart and so suave. Dugma ladavar hamishlah shivastiyamim bechaser ginas bitan amelech. Okay, so now what we begin to see is something dramatically different. We begin to see a king, ultimately again, who does everything to serve his ego and to bolster, solidify his monarchical standing and power. But you know what the interesting part is? Why? Now, before we get to the why, well, actually, let's get to the why. Why? You know, in life, you have to operate with one basic assumption. What is the most basic assumption you have to operate with in life? If you want to be able to be a successful member of the world, what is the most important, fundamental truth you have to operate with? People are good. People are good. You have to believe in the good of humanity. You have to believe in the good of people. I don't mean just good of Jews. I mean, you have to believe in the good of people. You have to believe that people at their core are good. If you don't believe that, so first of all, if you don't believe that, you end up leading a very cynical, jaded, and sarcastic life, which in general is very negative. Now again, Therefore, but yet, we see people do bad things all of the time. I don't mean, God forbid, like atrocity type things. I mean, like, people just do bad things all the time. It happens to us every single day. Whether it's family members, whether it's fellow Jews, whether it's Gentile, whoever it might be. So, if I believe that people are good at their core, but yet, I also know that people do bad things. So, how do I reconcile the two? How do I reconcile it? I reconcile by asking myself one question. If I believe that you're good, but then you do something bad, I ask myself, what's happening in your life? What is in a state of disrepair inside of you that is causing you to act out this way? If I believe that you're good, but at the end of the day you're doing something negative, that means there is some type of internal disconnect. What's the disconnect? Achashverosh, you are a balgaiva. You are an arrogant, self-serving, egocentric individual. What's wrong? What's wrong? What is in a state of disrepair inside of you that is causing you to act out in such, and when you look at it, it's almost like infantile. 180-day party to show off your treasure house? To show off your treasure house? Okay, you're the wealthiest man in the world. Shkoyach. We know it. You're the head of the largest empire on the face of the world. You need to sit here showing off your treasure houses to everyone? What's wrong? What's in the state of disrepair? So if you take a look at number 12, Rashi makes an amazing observation. So Rashi says again, this is in the beginning of the Megillah. When we are first introduced to Achashverosh, remember again, we are told, Vahimi Achashverosh, Hu Achashverosh, Hamolech Mehodu Ve'ad Kush. So Hamolech, what does Hamolech mean? Literally reign. But Rashi says in number 12, Hamolech, Shemalach Me'atzmo, V'lo Haya Mizera Hamalucha. There is a raging fundamental dispute about how did Achashverosh get the throne? How did he get the throne? So Rashi takes the approach, Shemolech me'atzmo, he was a self-appointed monarch, and what? V'lo mizera hamalucha. In other words, he didn't have royal blood. He didn't have royal blood. Now again, how exactly he was able to climb the ladder of success is also an incredible dispute. But before we get to that, take a look at number 13. Rav Soloveitchik writes, the term Hamolech, who was reigning, has the connotation of attempting to rule, of subjugating, of organizing the government, of being fearful of failure. The fact that Achashverosh was not yet firmly entrenched is responsible for many of the strange events. He was involved in solidifying his empire, and he judged every event in terms of how it would affect his rule over his kingdom. Had Achashverosh been sure of himself, he would have acted differently. Rav Soloveitchik makes an amazing observation. I didn't put it on the sheet, but there is a fundamental dispute in the Talmud about how Achashverosh actually climbed the ladder. So some say he was a very skilled warrior, skilled tactician. Others say, I guess what they would call dumb luck. Dumb luck. He just, I don't know exactly how dumb luck allows you to become the, you know, mightiest ruler of the mightiest empire of the world, but okay, dumb luck. Dumb luck, he becomes the mightiest ruler. But when you begin to understand this, there's an incredible feeling of inadequacy that Achashverosh has. There's something that gnaws at his kishkas. There's something that doesn't give him rest. Why? Because he knows deep down. You see, you have to understand something. In ancient world, the one thing that royalty prided itself most on, just you have to look at the ancient world. If you look at the last real remaining royalty, right? If you look at the Queen of England, right? So what does the Queen of England pride herself on most? Besides the jewels, right? What's the most important thing in ancient royalty? Pedigree. Pedigree. Royal blood. Is the idea that my father was a king, my grandfather was a king, my grandfather was the king. We come from a line of royalty. You know that there's an opinion in the Talmud that Achashverosh began his career working in the stables of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, remember, was the grandfather of Achashverosh's first wife, of Vashti. of Vashti. So how does Achashverosh, how does it begin? What are his summer jobs? He worked in the stable. Now, I don't have to explain this, but working in the stable is not the most coveted position, right? Working in the stable is not something that people line up and vie for, that kind of work. That's the lowest of the low. So we look at that, wow, what a success story. Incredible, you start out on the stables, from stables to throne, right? That's Achashverosh's biography, right? So again, incredible. It's fine, except in the world of ancient monarchy, where pedigree is everything. So if you began as a stable boy, it doesn't even matter what you end up accomplishing. One thing is clear, which is what? Which is what? You're a stable boy. You're never really the king. Even if you sit on the throne, even if you rule over 127 countries, you're never really the king. Or at least, says of Soloveitchik, in Achashverosh's mind, the one voice that he keeps hearing over and over and over is, you're a stable boy, you're a stable boy, you're a stable boy. That's what Achashverosh hears over and over. Living with an incredible feeling of inadequacy. Living in the shadow of every thinking that everyone is talking behind your back. Ah, he's not really the king. He's really a nothing. He's really just a peasant. He's really just a simple person. And Achashverosh plays this over and over and over in his mind. Achashverosh is plagued by an incredible feeling of inadequacy. And you know, my friends, there are two different ways that you could deal with feelings of inadequacy. Many of us struggle with feelings of inadequacy. So how do you deal with feelings of inadequacy? There are two ways. Number one, Vakshan, the one has feelings of inadequacy. Fantastic. Right? You deal with it. You confront your demons. I feel inadequate, but let me build myself up in a healthy way. Here's why I'm not inadequate. Here's why I'm special. Here's why I'm important. Here's why I'm meaningful. There's a way to deal healthily with feelings of inadequacy. How do you deal unhealthy with inadequacy? You go become a ridiculous Balgaiva. You become so ridiculously arrogant in an effort to mask all of you feeling. By the way, this is an incredibly helpful tool in interpersonal relationships, because sometimes you see people who seem to be so full of themselves, and you know, sometimes they annoy us, they upset us, they really rub us the wrong way. The truth is, the only feeling you should have is pity, because anyone who acts that way obviously deep down feels like a stable boy. Deep down, they just feel terribly about themselves, and they're masking it, they're overcompensating for it with this incredible overinflated ego. But it's just there to mask the little wounded child that just feels like they're nothing inside of them. That's Achashverosh. No matter how much money he has, no matter how much power he has, no matter how many countries he rules over, all he feels like is an inadequate stable boy. And my friends, when you begin to understand this psychological profile of Achashverosh, everything else begins to make sense. Achashverosh throws a dramatic party. In fact, if you look at number 14, the Malbim, and again, it's too long, you'll look at it on your own, but the Malbim frames the entire Purim story in a different way. He says, in the world of monarchies, we're going to blend the two in just a moment, in the world of monarchies, he says there are two different types of kingdoms. There's what's called a malchus mugbeles and a malchus bilti mugbeles. Literally, it means a confined monarchy and an unconfined monarchy. To perhaps borrow better terms, there's what's called a constitutional monarchy, and I guess what we'll call a dictatorial monarchy. What's the difference between the two? A constitutional monarchy, there are laws of the land, and the people appoint the king. The king is the servant of the people. The king's job is to execute the law of the land, but the king is bound by those same laws. Who does the treasury belong to? The treasury belongs to the country. The king is the minister of that treasury, but it does not belong to him. As opposed to a dictatorial monarchy, where ultimately, again, the king is in charge of everything. The king decides he's going to be king. The treasuries are the king. The king decides where the capital city is. Says the Malbim something amazing. Achashverosh, with his feelings of inadequacy, he feels that the only way to be successful is to privatize the monarchy. He has to become the dictator. So what does he do? He throws a major party. Where does he throw the major party? Where? Shushan. Anyone ever hear of Shushan before this story? No, you know why? because it was not the capital city of the Persian Median Empire. Shushan was Achashverosh's hometown. The first order of business that Achashverosh does is he moves the capital of the Persian Median Empire to Shushan. Why? Why? Because of the kosher restaurants? Right? Why? Why Shushan? And what's the answer? Because he could. Because he could. Because this was Achashverosh flexing his monarchical muscles. This was Achashverosh going ahead and saying, Ani Agever, beating his chest, I'm the man. I'm the man. I'm in charge. I'm moving the capital city of the Persian and Median Empire. No, I'm not asking anyone. No, I'm not getting focus groups together. No, I'm not soliciting opinions. No, I don't care what you think. I'm moving it simply because I can. What does he do over the course of the parties? Right? The course of the parties is one simple thing. To show everybody the treasuries. Why? Whose treasuries was he showing them? His treasuries. He effectively, during those 180-day parties, he effectively went ahead and privatized the entire treasury of the Persian Median Empire. He made it all his. Vashti. What happens with Vashti? So get ready for this. Malv makes an amazing observation. When Achashverosh summons Vashti to appear, so he refers to her as Vashti Hamalka, Vashti the Queen. When Vashti responds to Achashverosh, she responds to him as Hamalka Vashti. You hear the difference? He refers to her as Vashti the Queen. She refers to herself as Queen Vashti. What's the tension? He's summoning her. You see, Vashti has something that Achashverosh doesn't have, something that he's exceptionally jealous of, which is what?
Royal
blood. She's the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. She, Vashti, is royalty. When he summons her to appear in front of all of his guests, what is he doing? Leaving aside the Gemara that says that he ordered her to appear without her clothing, even leaving that aside, what was he doing when he orders her to appear? What he's showing everyone is, she's queen because of me. Because of me. Don't for a second think that I'm married into royalty or that she is my claim to the throne. She is queen because of me. I'm going to show you the proof. Vashti, appear. Look how she beckons. Look how she comes as I beckon. Look how she appears because I tell her to. Because I'm the king, and she is Vashti the Malka. She is the queen because she married to me. And Vashti is a woman that you don't mess with. And what does Vashti say? Excuse me, stable boy. No. I think you've got this wrong. You're not the royalty here. I am the royalty. I am not the queen because you are my husband. You are the king because I am your wife. Don't refer to me as Vashti the queen. You will refer to me as Queen Vashti. And now you understand why Achashverosh is placed in this incredible predicament. What's the predicament? The royalty, the royal blood, just publicly shamed him. Royal blood just publicly told him, don't tell me what to do. See, he's at an incredible crossroads. The whole point of this party is to solidify my monarchy. The whole point of this party is to go ahead and show that I am the boss. She, the Queen Vashti, just publicly defied me. So what happens? He has no choice, quote unquote, but to execute her. Execute her. And when he executes her, that was the ultimate sign of his authority. You see, the execution of Vashti did for Achashverosh more than the parties ever could. Because can you imagine what the general... Can you imagine when he executed Vashti, can you imagine the collective gasp that must have been heard? What? You just executed the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar? You just executed the monarchical pedigree. You just brought to an end one of the most illustrious monarchical lines of the Persian Median Empire. And when people saw this, they saw that Achashverosh had just effectively consolidated his dictatorial monarchy. At the end of the day, Achashverosh just accomplished solidifying all of the power in his hand. The capital city has been moved. The treasuries have been privatized. The queen is dead. And now, by the way, it gets even better. So what happens? Achashverosh goes out. He puts out a pageant. We have to find Mirzis Achashverosh number 2. Right? And what happens? Who does he choose? Who does he choose? Now we know she has lineage. What does Achashverosh know about her? That she's beautiful. That's all. No pedigree, no family, no nothing. Just the way he wanted it. He did not want royalty. He did not want pedigree. He did not want a family tree. He didn't want yichus. He didn't want yichus. In fact, again, he was so happy to find a beautifully stunning woman with absolutely no familial baggage. Now, again, of course, the great irony is she's a granddaughter of the first king of Israel, a great-great-granddaughter of the first king of Israel, of Shaul. She is a descendant of Shaul HaMelech, so she is monarchy in her own right. But that means, how could the most powerful man marry a woman who's totally anonymous? And the answer is, he loved it. He loved the anonymity. Why? Because it was always the Achashverosh show. It was always about him. It was always the need for him to be center stage. Ah, he's such a balgai, he's so arrogant. When you look at Achashverosh, there's one feeling that should sweep over you. And that's a feeling of pity. Poor man. Because you go through life feeling like a stable boy. You've accomplished so much, yet you can never really enjoy it. Why? Because for whatever the reason, you have never come to terms with your own feelings of inadequacy. And by the way, now the rest of the Megillah begins to make sense. So what happens? What happens when Haman comes with an incredible plan, great plan to go and wipe out the Jews? Was Achashverosh an anti-Semite? Was Achashverosh an anti-Semite? The truth is, we don't know. But what we do know is, what Haman came along and did is, he stoked the king's ego. This is not good for your monarchy. These Jews, they're not good for your monarchy. They're not good for the consolidation of your rule. So king, you really need to get rid of it. Okay, if it's not good for my monarchy, of course, here's my ring. Yo, Achashverosh, I'm going to give you money. I don't even need the money. If you're willing to consolidate my monarchy, you're a friend of mine. And then sure enough, when Esther goes ahead and pleads before the king, and what does Esther do? What does Esther do at the party? What does Esther do? She throws herself at the mercy of the king. What does she do? Achashverosh, my king, my husband, you are all powerful. My people and I live and die at your command. Wow. Live and die at my command, right? That's a nice thing to hear, right? That's good for the ego. So I hold, not only do I control 127 countries, but apparently, again, I also hold the key of life and death, right, to an entire nation. This feels good. And when he has the power to spare them, then ultimately, again, what does that do? It feeds his ego as well. The entire story of the Megillah, the entire story of Achashverosh, is the tragic story of a man who felt inadequate, of a man who had low self-esteem, of a man who, no matter what he was able to accomplish, ultimately, again, still felt like a little nothing stable boy. Now, again, I don't know, and we don't know what happened to Achashverosh's childhood. We don't know what happened to him with his parents. We don't know what happened, but it's a tragic story. And it's a story that plays itself over so many times in our own lives. You see, the story of the Megillah is what happens when you don't deal with your own personal baggage. The story of the Megillah is that whether you have feelings of inadequacy or any other feelings, if you don't confront them, acknowledge them, own them, and deal with them, they color your actions in all types of negative ways. Negative ways, often of which we are often unaware. You see, all of us do things, and we think we often know why we're doing the things we do. But very often, there are deep parts of our persona, there are deep parts of our personality that we have not yet embraced and don't fully understand, that often inform the way we act. Everything that Achashverosh does is informed by his feelings of inadequacy, are informed by his feelings of not measuring up. That despite the fact that he was the most powerful man in the organized world, he was never able to truly feel it. Therefore, he always casts his lot with whoever is going to stoke his ego. Now, Baruch Hashem, the story ended well for us because we were able to stoke his ego more than Haman. We were able to appeal to his feelings, to his need for validation, to his need for ego reinforcement more than anyone else. But that's the story of the Megillah. And that ultimately, again, the Megillah contains many messages, many, many different messages. But one of the messages is most of us, say differently, all of us have baggage. You know, as I often say, some of us just go through life with a carry-on. Some of us are using the one bag allowance. Some of us have had to pay for an extra suitcase. And some of us have, like, the porter who comes, you know, with the big thing. But we all have baggage. We all have baggage. For some of us, it's baggage from our childhood. For some of us, it's baggage from our life experiences, our adulthood. Some of us, it's relationship baggage. Some of us, it's personal baggage. Some of us, it's theological baggage, emotional baggage. We all have baggage of some sort. And we have to be brave enough to acknowledge it, to confront it, and to try to work through it. Because if we don't, it makes us unhealthy people. If we don't, it causes us to act in ways that are sometimes childish, infantile, and not in our best interests. The Megillah is a story of a man with an incredible amount of baggage who, for whatever reason, chose never to confront, and as a result, comes off looking like a capricious buffoon, comes off looking like a fool, comes off looking like a tipesh. And meanwhile, I don't believe Achashverosh was foolish. I don't believe Achashverosh was a tipesh. And I just believe Achashverosh was a broken person who never confronted his broken kite, who never went ahead and unpacked his baggage and tried to acknowledge it, own it, and fix it. And in fact, if you look at the end of the, if you look at the end, look at number 16, with this I'll conclude. There's an amazing halacha for Purim. The halacha is, Umashenogu lilbosh pirtzufim bepurim. You know, there's an incredible practice on Purim to get dressed up. To get dressed up. And in fact, again, on Purim we do things that you're not allowed to do through the rest of the year. The gever lovish simlas isha, the isha klei gever. You know, under normal circumstances, the halacha is, a man is not permitted to wear women's clothing, a woman is not permitted to wear man's clothing. Yet on Purim you're allowed to do these things. Purim, you could do these things. So it's always, and it's interesting practice. We dress up on Purim sometimes in the most outlandish and just crazy ways. Where does this practice come from? What does it have to do with? So if you take a look at number 18, so the Tam Amin Hagim writes as follows. Tam Amin Hagim says, Tam Shenago Lishtanos Malbushim Shonim Bizmanas Udov Simchas Purim. One of the reasons, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons we get dressed up on Purim, V'lo Davareku, this is not an empty practice. This is a meaningful practice. So remember again, this goes back to the fact that many understand the fact that Haman almost annihilated the Jewish people to an ancient sin, a previous sin. The fact that during the days of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had erected an idol of himself and the Jews had bowed down to it. So because the Jews worshipped idolatry of Nebuchadnezzar, therefore we were punished with Haman. But the Talmud in Hagim says when the Jews bowed down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar, they didn't mean it. Externally they bowed, but internally they believed in God. So too in the Purim salvation, externally it looked like things were going to be terrible, but behind the scenes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu orchestrated our salvation. Reminiscent of the costume. On the outside it looks one way, but of course when you remove the mask, you see the true person who's there. But I think perhaps on a deeper level, based on what we learned today, that this is the Purim story. You see, my friends, a lot of us walk around in costume, and not just during the year. Excuse me, not just on Purim, I should say. A lot of us walk around in costume during the year. We put on a face, we project a persona, but inside there's a lot that's broken. Inside there's a lot that's in a state of disrepair. And what Purim teaches us is that at some point in time, the facade of the costume has to come off. You know, on Purim, if you're wearing a costume, on Purim, if you're a grown man dressed up as a ballerina, everybody laughs. On the day after Purim, if you're a grown man dressed up as a ballerina, they'll probably call the authorities. Right? The idea being costumes are great, but they're only good for a limited amount of time. At some point in time, you have to take off the mask. At some point in time, you have to take off the costume. You have to confront the person you really are. And sometimes that confrontation is difficult, because sometimes that confrontation comes with incredible baggage, incredible pain, incredible wounds, and incredible scars. But unless we're willing to take off the costume, unless we're willing to take off the mask and to confront who we really are, we end up living like an Achashverosh. And living like an Achashverosh might have its highs, but at the end of the day, you always live with those feelings of inadequacy. I'm a stable boy. No matter what our baggage is, all of us are great. All of us are special. All of us are wonderful. Purim teaches us to have the strength that Ahasuerus never did. Ahasuerus never confronted. He just wore the mask of this incredible, mighty monarch and dictator. But he never took off the mask to confront the broken stable boy who was the dominant personality on the inside. May we be privileged, as we celebrate Purim, to find the strength that he couldn't, to remove the mask, to confront the people we really are, to embrace the people we really are, and if there is baggage, if there are scars, if there are wounds, to find the courage to confront them, to find the courage to try to the best of our ability to fix them, and then to find the courage to self-actualize and become the people we're truly capable of becoming. Thank you.